Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Russ Terry, the founder and CEO of Life Coach Radio Networks. Today's sponsor is Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio entertainment and information. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free audiobook when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/lifecoachradio. That's audibletrial.com/lifecoachradio. And now, here's today's show.
Good evening, everyone. This is Reverend Jen Kotler, and you're listening to Spiritually Speaking with Reverend Jen and Rebecca.
Hi.
We are excited to be here tonight. Hey, Rebecca.
Hi.
We are really excited to be here tonight, as we are every Monday, second and fourth Monday of the month. Tonight is December the 8th at 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Central. And if you're listening to us live, we encourage you to call in with your questions and your comments. Our guest call-in line is area code 646-716-9397. That's 646-716-9397. And tonight we have a special guest on with us that we're really excited about, Reverend Mark Sandlin. Mark is an ordained minister in the Presbyterian Church from the South. He's a co-founder of the Christian Left. His blog, which is the God article, was recently named as one of the top 10 Christian blogs. Mark has a slew of awards. He's been featured on PBS and NPR. But most importantly, he's married to an amazing and fabulous Baptist minister and has two great teenagers. And is looking forward to, as he says in his bio, to having a beverage in one hand and a book in the other as he and his wife look out across the shores of Ocracoke, North Carolina. So,
amen. Welcome. Ooh, Mark.
Is there anything in that I possibly didn't talk about that you want folks to know?
You know, the one thing I should say, and this is my fault because I don't publicize it well, we also have a podcast called The Moonshine Jesus Show that we have so much fun on. I do it with a buddy of mine, David Henson, who's an Episcopal priest.
Nice.
That's great.
So
yeah, I love
it. I would just add that.
Yeah, The Moonshine Jesus Show. And actually, I did put that in the keywords for this episode.
That's great.
Just in case some of your folks out there are looking for us and looking forward to listening to you on the web. And Rebecca,
that's
you have been super busy. Rebecca, as many of our regular listeners know, is a student at Union Theological Seminary in New York, and they have been incredibly active on the ground since the grand jury failed to return any indictments in the Eric Garner case in Staten Island. And Rebecca, I'm just wondering if you could bring our listeners up to speed on what's happening there.
Yeah, I'm happy to do that. So basically, Union Seminary has become really the hub for the faith-based protesting that's happening here in New York. We have a 24-hour call and command center where we are staffed full-time. We have a hotline. People can call when they've been arrested, and we get them, whatever they need from the Lawyers Guild. We have meals, food 24 hours a day, cots for people to sleep on. There are people coming in doing massages and aromatherapy and pastoral. In fact, I'm on a break right now. I'm the pastoral care student on call. So what that means is people just come in and need a a hug or someone just to talk to. And I can tell you that I've been in that room for different amounts of time, sometimes for 20 minutes, sometimes for 4 or 5 hours. And there's never a time that I'm in there that someone doesn't walk in and cry. So it's just real, you know, it's just a lot. And we are committed to making sure that this movement and this cause is perpetuated to the point of policy change, social change, church change, whatever we need to do to make sure that these policies and practices are not perpetuated in our governmental system, but also I think more importantly for me in our churches, and looking at how we perpetuate racism and prejudice and oppression from the pulpit and from our committee meetings and our, you know, Sunday dinners. So that's the short of it. And I'm actually really curious to hear from Mark and from you, Jen, too. You know, I feel like I'm in a briar patch here in New York, and I'm curious to know what the feeling is in the rest of the country.
See, that's so funny, because it's exactly what I was about to ask you. I know that everything that we see is filtered through corporate media.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm really curious about what your perception of your local community's reception of the movement that y'all are doing. What is that like? What kind of feedback are you getting? What's your sense of how the community around you is viewing what you're doing?
Well, I'll tell you that we are very careful in our particular local community here, because we don't want to, we're in Harlem. Mm-hmm. And we don't want to, you know, there's no shutdowns going on in Harlem. So everything we do is downtown, which in Manhattan, you know, Manhattan's a really small area, but downtown feels like a world away.
In so many ways, it really is a world away.
It's a 45-minute, you know, situation to get downtown. And so we feel like we... You know, what we're doing here on campus is sort of it's like a command center, you know, and then we sort of send these people out to go do the work. And what was really powerful today was the clergy leaders, New York City clergy, going to City Hall. And the report was that they sang, lots of singing, and then went into, were able to get in onto the floor and chanted 11 times Black Lives Matter, or I'm sorry, 11 times I Can't Breathe, which is how many times Eric Garner said it. And then they went back out into the rotunda and did a die-in. And for those people who don't know what that is, it's basically people lying down on the ground for, you know, several minutes. So they died for 11 minutes. And then they stood up singing We Shall Overcome. And, you know, it's really powerful to hear these reports of people these are students, you know, a lot of these people are 22, 23 years old, right out of undergrad, you know, sort of came to the big city of New York, you know, to go to, you know, church school. and so here we are. So I would say that the community around us, including the interfaith community, I mean, we're all in the same boat. We all feel very much like this is a team effort. You know, this is going to take a team, and it's going to take a lot of patience, a lot of grace, There's been a lot of conversation about being very careful about who is leading these marches. One thing that happened a couple of nights ago was that one of the march leaders happened, or one of the people who happened to get a bullhorn within the march was a white man. And that just didn't sit well with a lot of people. And so, you know, there have been a lot of discussions about making sure that the right voices are being heard. And I say right voices, you know, I recognize that we recognize that white men have a voice and that it's valid. But there's a real
appropriateness to the voices that need to be heard right now.
I think so. And I think there's something powerful about hearing people speak in the first person about these things.
Absolutely.
So frankly, you know, hearing women of color, trans women of color, has been a big concern, making sure that, you know, there's an understanding that this is not just a women's issue, this is not just a race issue, but even within the race issue is this other issue of LGBTQ issues. You know, so anyway, so that's a long answer, Mark, to your question, and I appreciate the question, and again, I'd love to hear from you guys. You know, kind of what your sense of the issue is where you are, and also your sense of what is coming from New York.
Yeah, Mark, I'll be happy to let you jump in, because I think maybe the coverage in Greensboro may be a little different than what we're getting here in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, honestly, I would have to claim a small amount of ignorance about the coverage, because I intentionally avoid mass media.
Right.
Really have much trust that what I'm seeing isn't filtered in some way that's not. So all I can really talk about is my experience through social media and what I'm seeing. And it's interesting, because what I'm seeing is that with Eric Gardner and Ferguson kind of happening one after the other, what I'm seeing is starting to be a dividing line of a clear, seeing clearly that some people recognize severe racial biases of the system,
mm-hmm.
and other people, even liberals, really don't quite get it and don't see it. And it's interesting to watch that line start being defined fairly clearly in different groups.
Mm.
In some ways, that's almost helpful, because I think that there was a false sense that if someone that's identified as progressive, they sort of understood. But we're seeing folks who are progressive kind of saying, well, whoa, 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 wait a minute. You know, there's some good reasons why these things happen. And, you know, it was a court. So how are you arguing? And you start realizing that, you know, there's some folks who are missing the larger picture of how this is it's representative of a systemic issue in all of the way that we function in our nation right now. And it also shows some people are living in such a place of privilege that they're completely blinded to the realities of a very large percentage of the population.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's astute.
those divisions were certainly there and have been there for a very long time.
We were founded on this tradition.
Yes,
you know?
Exactly.
I mean, it's the history of the founding of this nation. And it's sort of funny, if we think that we can found a nation on the genocide of one nation and enslavement of another, and that we wouldn't have these long-term issues if we just kind of act like it never happened.
Yeah.
We're being really quite naive, and we have been for far too long.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I think, too, one of the perceptions or the perspectives that I have sort of gained from, and I do listen to the mainstream media with a filter,
a grain of salt,
mm-hmm.
the whole thing,
mm-hmm.
right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
coaching is what it might appear at first blush.
Sure.
But it is really interesting how it is portrayed as these are more or less isolated incidents.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That these are not the lived realities of people of color in urban communities.
Yeah, that's a much safer story for people who have power to talk about it than it being a reality of life.
Right. Yes. Yes. And something we talk about here is that we are living out theology. You know, we are living out, I mean, you know, both of you have been to seminary, so you know that there's some books involved. You know, there's like some papers that you have to write and some exams you have to take. But we happen to be smack dab right now in the middle of exams and finals, and you know, timing is not on our side with that. But that's just the point. Is that's part of this education, and I think for people who aren't in seminary, you know, it's part of our social education, you know, and part of our work as people of faith or people who just give a damn.
Yeah, I think you make a great point. I mean, it calls up the question of if those who are followers of the teachings of Jesus and believers in God aren't embodying God and those teachings, then what value is there in any of them?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm curious,
Mark. What they're doing is embodying that, I would say.
Exactly. I'm curious, Mark, what you feel... how you feel this topic and this issue belongs, how you feel it should manifest from the pulpit?
That's one of those, and every time we talk about the pulpit, it becomes a difficult question because there's the theological embodiment and the pastoral embodiment.
Mm-hmm.
And the theological embodiment seems to have a very clear direction because the theological embodiment needs to be about valuing those who are marginalized, equality of all, and our responsibility to listen, to be caring and loving, and to help in the ways that we're told would be most helpful.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
theologically, that's where the space of God and the teaching of Jesus lead us to, I would say. But then you have to bring it down locally to the churches that you're in, and the pastoral edge gets a little more tricky of how much can you do without destroying a community that provides other things. I'm of the opinion that you should always push that edge. Of course, I'm not in a church because I do that.
So mm-hmm.
I may not be the person to listen to.
More about that, Mark. Like, tell us, like, what's the history? If you care to talk about, you know, your position to not be in a church.
Well, I was in a church, and basically because I was, by a small percentage of the members there, looked at as a far too progressive person who talked about far too much about equality and our responsibility to those in need from the pulpit, but I'm not going to get to details, but I basically got ran out of the church by that small
group. That sounds like fun.
Yeah, it's an interesting experience, and you begin to have to question yourself about what's really important. Will you continue to stand on this ground that, in a lot of ways, is your fullest current understanding of God and who God asks us to be? If it's going to risk my job and my family and the income of a family, is this something I still stand on? You have this, I would say, bad instinct to begin favoring fully the pastoral edge and let go of it. Say, well, the most caring thing to do is not to push these folks so far that they're hurt. And you have that moment where you're faced with this dilemma of do I lean towards the theological? Do I lean towards the pastoral? And the easy way really, truly is to lean towards the pastoral because it smooths everything over.
Right,
And I think, and I'm not making judgment of those who make that choice, there are probably situations and lives and communities where that is the best, even theological choice. For me and who I am, I couldn't do that.
Right.
to the chagrin of, I mean, because honestly, some of the people who were at that church were hurt that I did it, because they were there because they wanted to be at a church where we were feeding more people each week than we had in worship. We were doing a thing we called the Mobile Sandwich Brigade, where we would take the food out to street corners and having real conversations with folks, not evangelizing, just finding out who they were and what's going on and is there anything we can do to help. We were doing ESOL classes every day of the week. I mean, we were doing a lot of great stuff. And so making the choice to favor the theological direction that these kind of issues need to be addressed from the pulpit in terms of what I felt actually ended up hurting people there who agreed with me, because it caused me to have to leave the church so that people could continue to be fed, so that, you know, first arrivals in the U.S. still had a place to go to learn how to more readily get involved in the community without all of these language barriers and things. So it's a really tricky thing. It really genuinely is.
I can't agree more. I mean, I think that there is this ongoing challenge of where and to what extent do you push that line.
Right.
And the last few weeks I've been doing pulpit supply in a Presbyterian church here in the Chicago metro area, and I'm preaching again this Sunday.
Yeah.
And I am finding that I'm preaching a sermon that is for Advent that is on Mary's text of being willing to bear Christ. From her encounter with the angel Gabriel, and I cannot preach that sermon about what it means for each one of us to bear Christ in the world, and not utter the words Ferguson in New York.
It seems to me that when you're supply, you get a little more leniency because
you get to
kind of not worry as much about, not that you don't worry about it, but there's less need. You don't have the even ability to be as pastorally concerned because you don't actually know the community.
Well, exactly. And you know, Serene Jones, the president here at Union, on MSNBC yesterday and talked about Black baby Jesus. And like there are many, 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 many mainline Protestant progressive churches in this country that you would not say that from the pulpit. True. You just would not talk about Black Jesus. And she had, I think, you know, it's like you were saying, Mark, like she had the ability to say those things because speaking to a church community is a totally different thing, and speaking to a church community that you are, you know, installed and accountable to session and that kind of thing is,
you're sending off this crazy idea in my head. What we need is this massive movement amongst progressive ministers to do intentional pulpit exchange over this period.
Mark.
So, it just makes sense because then you get to go past those edges and talk about these things that really are, in many ways, there's a spiritual demand that they be talked about right now as they matter from pulpits. And that's a way that you could do it and not actually deeply wound the church, but push them and make them start thinking about
how that
matter. It's an interesting idea.
Send me information.
Yeah, for the first 10 years of my ministry, I did almost exclusively pulpit supply. I was, invited to come and preach because of my work in justice and advocacy. And if there wasn't a pressing issue like there is now that needed to be spoken about, I would talk to the pastor ahead of time. Right. And I would say, are there any issues that you would just love for me to raise the pulpit? Because I will be happy to do it, because I'm going to leave, and I'm not going to leave you with a mess that you don't want to deal with, but I'd love to leave you with a mess that you do want to deal with. So let's have a conversation.
This is really good for me because I'm doing my first like sort of planning of a worship service for the spring at a UU church in North Carolina, actually. And I asked one of the members, I said, what does your congregation need to hear? And they were like, oh, well, you know, we like to have like a nice story and, a little discussion. And I was like, no. Like, what is missing? Like, what are people afraid to talk about? Or what do they don't they want to like bring to the surface because it feels too whatever? And that was like a really interesting discussion. Because Jen knows this and others know this, but I love to push an envelope. And, you're right, Mark, like, and Jen too, like it makes sense to go in and create something in the space that the leaders feel like is good for that space, not to just go in and like rock the boat for the sake of rocking the boat.
Sure.
That's really awesome.
A guest would have the leeway to do that. And if you're doing an exchange, then the church that you're at is actually that minister's at the church that you serve. And it'd be beneficial for you both to have the conversation ahead of time and understand where you can go. And that would allow the conversation to move further. Yeah, it'd be an interesting thing.
Mm-hmm. Mark, what is your preaching life like right now? Do you get into the pulpit or are you...
Sure, I do some pulpit supply at this point, but I've kind of hit the space in my ministry that I get contacted a lot about pulpit supply, and after I talk to people, I frequently am not really literally uninvited, but we kind of mutually decide maybe it's not time.
All right.
Basically what I say is, look, at this point, I am who I am, and my theology is where it is. Mm-hmm. And so my sermons aren't going to pull back from that. They are going to be really, really progressive in terms of social justice, in terms of equality, in terms of what are we as Christians if we're not embodying all of these things? It will be somewhat critical of church structures and how they allow us to have kind of these in privileged lifestyles of I give, so I deserve something rather than I have a responsibility. And I'm very honest up front, it's going to end up in one of those places. And if your church, if that's not what your church needs to hear right now, I'm probably not who you want. I've been out of my church for about 3 months now, and I've probably been pulpit supply four times since then.
Okay.
Because of that, I've done other talks and I have traveled to do different conversations and stuff. But for pulpit supply, I just try to be honest. I say, this is who I am. My blog puts it out there. I don't hide a lot of things. I'm probably overly truthful for my own good. And so you can go there and you can read it and you can see. And if that's not what your church needs right now, then let's just move on.
Definitely, you're in the position as I am, Mark, where all you have to do is Google your name.
That's right.
And you'll find out way more about me and about you than anybody ever wanted to know.
That is all so true. I am embarrassed how many Google pages get hit. It's ridiculous.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, listen, we are, I know y'all can't believe this, but we are at the halfway point, and I want to remind folks of our call-in number. That is 646-716-9397, 646-716-9397. We're talking tonight with Reverend Mark Sandlin, who is a pastor and a blogger and a speaker and a writer and a thinker and whatever else, husband and a dad.
I used to get accused of being a troublemaker, too. So.
Troublemaker. Maybe even a heretic, but in the best way possible. And I consider that high praise. So if you'd like to join the conversation, Please give us a call. If you are holding, please feel free to call back. We're sort of ready to bring some more folks into the conversation. So I'm just curious, Mark, what do you see in addition to kind of the ways in which we're responding to these our social crises at the moment? Where do you see the real kind of growing edge, if you will, or the ways in which church is changing or church is needing to change in order to be able to really respond to issues?
Yeah, I think it's interesting to consider where the church is right now. And for me, Diana Butler Bassett, Phyllis Tickler are the go-to people on this, both from a larger historical and in terms of the church, and then Diana Butler Bassett, what she's done on the history of the church in the U.S. is just astounding. And what they both lead you to realize is that we're in a moment right now that we've never been at before in the life of the church. And part of that's about the long history of the church. Part of that's about the growth cycle of the church. And we have so much hierarchy and dogma that's built up that there's this great resistance to change, but society has changed so greatly that the church is in need of something. And so there's this tension and struggle within the church trying to figure out what it's going to be. And until that happens, I think that the church struggles to respond to things like Ferguson, like Eric Gardner. And so it's interesting that these things are happening right now because the church hasn't quite sorted out how it's going to get through what it's in the midst of the struggle of the kind of the importance of our history, but the importance of how do we continue to engage society in a way that allows us to talk about the teachings of Jesus and who God is to us and how that matters in our lives. So I wonder if what's going to happen is because of the severe need for a spiritual response to these situations. Mm-hmm. And the current, and I'm going to modify this after I say it, the current inability of the church to respond to it. There's certainly parts of the church that are responding really, really well. And Rebecca, what you guys are doing is obviously a very clear sign of that. But if we're all honest, it's a small percentage of the institutionalized church that's managing to do this.
Well, and also union is not a church.
Right, but you're a representative of spiritual
communities
that feed
sure.
into churches and that kind of thing. So I think that what we're seeing is an outfalling of a buildup of history of hierarchies and dogma and traditions that are more inflexible than we want to admit they are. And it becomes very difficult for them to deal with current events that are challenging and introduce stress into the system. And so I wonder if what's going to happen, that all of the history that's happening in front of our eyes that are showing the problems with our larger national systems aren't going to force new spiritual communities to pop up that are capable of responding spiritually to these situations while the church struggles with how to manage.
Wow. That's real powerful.
Of what you imagine that will look like?
Well, I have my guesses. I think personally what I think is that we're going to see, for a very long time, the church has been a very thick hierarchical structure. So what we receive is from the top down, which means there's a lot of power structures involved, which almost always means that if you go to church in Maine and you go to church in New Jersey and you go to church in New Mexico, you pretty much see the same thing over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
Within a denomination in particular. My guess is what we're going to see is things popping up that has a reverse direction of power, where the power is centered in the communities and that what each community looks like is based very much on, one, the gifts of those who gather, and two, the needs of the community that's around. And I suspect that it's going to look different in each space, even what they do when they gather.
Mm.
I'm not sure that worship will look like a performance. I think worship will look like activity.
Wow. Wow. Mark, I'd love to ask you specifically about the Presbyterian Church. As is that is my.
So
that is
in other words,
my...
you want me to get defrocked is what you want to do. Go for it. I'm working on that myself, I think.
Well, as a person who's in the ordination process in the Presbyterian Church, you know, and I also work for a Presbyterian church, you know, so I'm not asking you to do my dirty work and say all the things that I can't say out loud. But,
no, absolutely.
But, you know, there's plenty of big, pink elephants in the room. And I'm just curious, you know, obviously after the recent, GA decisions and General Assembly for those. And those of you who don't know what that means. And so the recent General Assembly decision, you know, churches leaving the denomination, all kinds of things. I'm just curious where you see the Presbyterian Church going, or what needs to change?
Yeah. Well, I'm actually weird in that I'm a big fan of the churches that are leaving. And here's why: people who have to deal with the financial repercussions of that are just like whatever they're listening to us on right now. They're smashing it because they don't want to hear that. But here's the thing. The LGBT issue, biblically, is not a significant issue, and we spend a great deal of our time dealing with it. So I am all about the folks who disagree about whether or not we find that our folks, our friends and our brothers and sisters who are LGBT have equality. If the folks who don't want that decide to go somewhere else and form their own little group, I'm all about that because it means we get to stop fighting about it, and we get to start focusing on what really matters in terms of helping those who need to be fed, those who, not that the LGBT community doesn't need to be helped, but I think that allows us to even move even further forward in making sure that equality is extended that way. So I'm a fan of that. Now, in terms of what's going to happen with PCUSA, there are glimmers of hope for me, like the 1001 communities, that program. I think if it's operated in a really well-conceptualized way, I think it has a great chance of being successful if they're willing to step back and allow those communities to function on their own and not try to push.
Our listeners, Mark, what that is?
Well, 1001 Communities is a direct effort by the PCUSA to allow new worshiping communities to kind of pop up, and not only allow it, but to provide financial support for this. It's relatively, in terms of these kind of things, early in its stages. So I'm going to be curious to see how free they're willing to allow those communities to be, and how much structure and how much Presbyterianism, like I call it, our polity, they're willing to push on them and say you have to do this. Because I'm of the opinion that in all denominations is probably our biggest downfall, is that we are. In some ways, we don't just worship God, we worship our systems as well.
Absolutely.
And until we're willing to deconstruct our systems and allow the people to become more important and figure out how to redesign our systems from bottom up, I'm not sure that we'll ever be okay. And I'm going to do a quick little side route. The part of the reason for that, in my opinion, is our structures are, not surprisingly, perfectly designed to receive the results that they get. And the results that they get is that we know something's wrong. We get to talk about it. We get to think about it. We get to introduce programs that might change it. We get to change just enough that it feels like we're doing something. But their structures, they're inflexible. They only flex enough to make it feel like we're doing something, but it never allows it to be enough that significant change happens. And so I think until we address the actual systems, which we're not really doing, we're probably fated to keep repeating the cycle that we've seen. Actually, if we're honest, we've been repeating it. It was more than 20 years ago that people started recognizing the church was having a problem and needed to do something. And we've kind of been in just a cycle of repetition since then.
You know, I'm right there with you, and I, at the risk of getting up on my own soapbox, I feel like, this comes back to, that sort of topic at hand, in that systems are not challenged because the people running them benefit from them. And
that's right.
You know, so I you know, for example, a church, a PCUSA church that I know of that's discerning whether or not to leave the denomination, one of the biggest reasons not to is because the pastor doesn't want to give up his pension. Right. So it's, I mean, so, you know, he's willing to like sit in the sick system, you know, to make sure that he has a good retirement. And it's just really, I think that's what is, I think that's what's frustrating about working for these organizations. I think that's what's exciting about being, about having the energy to work in them, because y'all know, and I'm learning, that these systems are going to change whether people like it or not. And it's such important work for us to be helping those, you know, to sort of be ushering those changes, because, you know, change is difficult and people are going to feel that pull and that, and so I think, you know, when people, when the system, I don't know that the system will ever crumble, right, but when it shifts, you know, when there's an earthquake, people like you, Mark, I think are, you know, then they're going to go, oh, wait, Mark, we really need you here. Like, you know.
I don't know about that. But at this point, I'm kind of pretty sure they're going to, it's going to be a very long time before they just think that they need me.
I don't know, man. I don't know.
Who knows? I can tell you what it feels like. I can tell you what it feels like from my chair. And it seems like the more I talk, the deeper trouble I get into.
It's a complicated problem for sure.
Very complicated situation. And I just want to give our guest call-in number again and invite folks to call in if you have a question or a comment. If you want to join our conversation, our call-in number is 646-716-9397, 646-716-9397. Yeah, I know that it certainly is so. From your vantage point right now, Mark, I think questionable as to how quickly there might be some invitation from other parts of the church to be more prophetic. But you know, we've had a number of you know, guests on the show, Sarah Buteau from Common Ground in Massachusetts. And we've certainly had Doug Padgett with Solomon's Porch, and you know, the fact that there are these faith communities that are being born, that are thriving, and they're still, you know, and like you said, Mark, they're coming from the bottom up, and they don't look like traditional church.
Exactly.
They look more like a fellowship dinner than they do traditional church. And yeah, what were you going to say, Rebecca? Do you want to
I'm agreeing with all of this. I'm just affirming. Yes.
and it's interesting, you know, I know that we've had Sarah on, and it was a wonderful show where we talked about just the ways in which children are being included in every aspect of the life of the congregation. And there is none of, you know, segregation. So all of the songs that they sing are call and response. You don't have to be able to read in order to participate in the music. And just really great, great, great emerging communities that don't look like what we're used to seeing is church, and the people who come don't look like the people that we usually are kind of used to seeing in church.
Sure. I think that the thing about that is what you're talking about are communities that are popping up outside of existing denominations. And within denominations, it's very hard for those places to find ground because there is an expectation of existing structure and polity and behavior that tends to get pushed on them pretty quickly. And those things are designed over time, almost unintentionally to some degree. Some of it is certainly intentional. But over time, they're designed to cause communities to look like all the other communities.
Right.
And I'm not sure we're going to escape that.
Yeah, I'm going to push back a little bit on that because I think some of the communities we are that are seeing, certainly Common Ground is part of a UCC.
Well, we're talking UCC. I think we have to throw UCC and Universalists
We have St. Lydia's in Brooklyn, which is being born out of the ELCA, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America,
I was getting ready to
for its necessarily progressive and inventive forms of worship. So I do think that these are being born under church structures, sort of with the understanding that, you know what, this is not going to look like regular church.
Yeah, I would argue that most of them still look more like the structure that they're existing in than the churches that are popping up outside of it.
Well, and I'll say this.
Not that they look just like it, but more like it.
Right. I think also, you know, these churches that are popping up within the denomination are having some real denominational challenges, mostly around funding. And, you know, what's interesting to watch is that the denominations want them. They say, oh, yes, we want these new and interesting and progressive style worship communities, and we want them to be diverse, and we want them to be informal and all this stuff. But then when they, you know, the circle that I run in, you know, sort of say, you know, the folks that I work with sort of say, well, they say yes to everything until you say, well, okay, well, this is going to cost money.
Well, and here's some of the psychological edge of that. So the folks who tend to have control of the money aren't typically the folks who are involved in this new community that is hoping to look different.
Right.
What happens when you participate in a traditional or a more standard looking service and this non-traditional new one starts being successful, what kind of commentary does that make about what you're doing?
About the status quo, exactly.
Right, that's slowly dying, slowly not gaining. And there is this sort of psychological edge to all of it where between the existing structure that's semi-flexible and the psychological, almost subconscious level that folks have to deal with a successful thing that looks very different, there's going to be some success stories. I would be happily surprised if it's a high percentage. If it's a high percentage, just because the deck is stacked against that. It's just stacked against it.
Do you think that organized religion is bad?
Organized religion, is it bad?
Yes.
Well, institutionalized religion ultimately becomes its own god over time because of the power and the money that becomes involved in it. I think Phyllis Tickle does a great job of talking about how every 500 years there's new structures. I think that's a life cycle that responds to that reality, because I think that the reality is kind of part of what the darker side of humanity about striving for power and the ability to control other people or to have some position of lordship over them. I think we've seen it in our history. That's always been the case. So it's not unusual that the church does that, but she points that every about 500 years that tipping point happens and something new pops up. So I don't know that it's evil in itself or bad in itself or anything like that. because I think there's a lot of positives that come out of it. There's much larger good that can be done when we unite together that way. But I think we have to recognize that the structures naturally tend towards, over time, building up power and hierarchy, and that, you know, I think maybe the perfect system comes together and intentionally creates corporate religion, but recognizes that it's only good for a certain period of time, and then it needs to be restructured. So you build that into your founding documents.
Mm-hmm.
Every, mm-hmm. I don't know, 100 years, we intentionally throw it all away and start again.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that. I mean, I'm not an expert in that area, but that makes some sense to me, that when you look at our history, we're on top of, I think, the fourth or the fifth time that's going to happen. And it's pretty clear we're in the space where that's going to happen. So why not recognize the realities behind that and create a structure that cuts us off before we get to that really unhealthy space, and intentionally recreates itself on a continual basis for the sake of making sure that power structures don't build up, or making sure that hierarchies don't become, you know, it's far too controlling, and that even our dogma isn't near limits. That seems to be a reasonable approach.
Awesome. Well, Mark, you know, I just have a couple more questions. I want to just let everybody know we've got about 8 minutes left in the show tonight. So if you'd like to call in, you have any questions or comments, you want to talk to Mark, this is your opportunity. It's the call-in number is area code 646-716-9397, 646-716-9397. I'm curious, just in all of the material, the written material, your blogging, everything that you've put out there in the past few years, I'm wondering if there is one single thing that, you know, got more of a reaction, where you really felt like you hit a nerve more than...
Well, the single biggest piece I've ever written, and through the other blogs that have requested to host it, through a couple of different languages it's been translated into, I've had over 500,000 people read it.
Wow.
It's a piece called Clobbering Biblical Gay Bashing.
Wow.
Just a breakdown of the clobber verses, and my particular perspective of why they're not talking about the things we think they're talking about, and about how we're a little bit messed up if we're using the Bible as a sex manual to start with. And that piece has had... I did not realize that it would garner the kind of traffic. It's really way ridiculously too long for a blog post.
Wow.
It's a chapter in a book length. Matter of fact, that's what it was actually. It was an appendix to a book. That's why I actually wrote it for it, and it ended up not getting used. So I just put it out just because I felt like, well, I put 3 weeks of my life into this. I ought to put it somewhere. So I put it out on the internet, not expecting anything and at this point. So that would be the single piece I would have to point to. Then maybe the next one is what ended up putting me into Huffington Post and Sojourners and getting me to be able to write there. And it was I took a 3-month sabbatical and intentionally didn't go to church for the first time in my entire life. At the age of 40 something, just said, I'm just going to stop going to church and find out what these nuns are discovering in life. Why do they like not going to church so much? And I did a blog series on it, and that's what Huffington Post and both the Huffington Post and Sojourners both approached me because of that piece. And so those would probably be the two. Those would be the two most significant.
We've had
some other really fun ones that I think modeled what nonviolent resistance looks like that had some great following too. And I think those are much more fun than the other two.
Wow.
So what's next? What are you working on?
I'm working on a book, but this is the third book I've been working on. We're trying to find the right one, and so hopefully that happens soon. We continue to work on the Moonshine Jesus Show because it's only 9 months old, and it's embarrassingly successful. We have no idea what people like to show up and listen to us talk, but we're really, really glad that they do. And I'm not sure beyond that. I plan on doing a lot of writing. I'm waiting to see for the next thing, whatever is the right fit. So I'll keep doing the Christian Left. I'll keep doing my blog, the God article, and we'll keep doing the Moonshine Jesus show and see where it all takes us.
That's really exciting. Thank you so much, Mark. For the folks listening, you know, when we talked briefly before we went live, I explained that what was going on at Peer Union, and that, you know, I really am appreciating the power of the term headspace, and I made the statement that, you know, this action is taking up a lot of my headspace, and Mark, I'm really grateful that you so graciously brought that into your into our dialogue tonight. And it sounds like that it's really a part of your work. So
I don't mean this in any kind of "oh, look how humble Mark is" way. What you're doing there is so much more significantly important than any of the stuff I've written somewhere on the internet. What you're doing there matters. I'm glad we were able to talk about it.
Well, thank you, Mark. And I mean, I got to say, you know, I'm in seminary because of people like you and people like Jen. And, you know, the work that I do is meaningful to me, but it comes from a place of being taught to do it. And so I'm grateful for my church leaders, for my faith leaders, I'm just grateful for this time in our time to do this kind of work. Which, you know, I mean, the cliche is I wish we didn't have to. But
and the reality, you know, is we always will.
We always will, you know.
And it's important that we do.
Yeah, I mean, a few years ago it was Occupy Wall Street, and then before that it was the war, and before that it was 9/11. And,
yeah,
you know, I don't mean to make these issues sound trivial, but there's always work to be done. And, yeah. You know, I appreciate your time. And you too, Jen, you know, just graciously, you know, bringing all of this into the conversation is I think really good. So
Rebecca, we're glad you're on the ground. We're glad that you and the folks at Union are being that witness in that city right now. It's so desperately needed. A good pastor who is the UCC conference pastor here in Illinois years ago, James Fissler Hoffman, once looked at me and said, "Jen, I just want to thank you for doing ministry while the rest of us are, you know, doing what we have to do."
right.
You know, we thank you for doing ministry while doing what we need to do, you know, both inside and out of the church, but that's real ministry and witness. And really where, you know, Jesus has always stood with the marginalized and with those who needed a voice. And so as Christians, we are just very thankful that voice is being shared, and it's being shared in Christ's name.
Amen.
And we really appreciate that on so many levels.
Well, it's good to be a part of this conversation as this person who isn't doing this work. So, for listeners, I want to lift up this community and other people who are doing really, frankly, quite dangerous things every day for this cause. And if you don't know what's going on, if you're not sure what we're talking about. You know, please, you know, look on whatever balanced media is you can find. Which I don't even really know what that is, but there's a lot of issues to be learned about and to be discussed. And I encourage people to take them to their churches and to their circle meeting and their knitting clubs and men's groups, and talk about these things in a real way.
Amen. Amen. Well, we are at our hour mark, and certainly if folks want to follow up with Mark, what's your Twitter handle? You know, where can they find you on Facebook?
Absolutely. At Mark Sandlin on Twitter. And then look for me on the God article on Facebook, or just Mark Sandlin on Facebook.
Wonderful. And as always, you can like us, Spiritually Speaking with Reverend Jen and Rebecca, on Facebook. Rebecca is at A New Rebecca on Twitter. I'm at Coach Rev Jen on Twitter. You know, please like our Facebook page. Have some conversation. Let us know what you think of the show tonight, and what ideas you have, what conversations you would like for us to have in the future. We are always open to input from any and all of our listeners, and we're just thankful. So, Rebecca, you want to close us out?
I do. I'm going to close us out with just a little bit. We don't, if you're comfortable praying over the phone, that's great, but I'm just going to say a little meditation. You know, God, we're here because you're here. We're here because you were there. You wept when Jesus was crucified by sending an earthquake. And God, please let us be that earthquake as your children are dying. Please let our feet be that earthquake. Amen.
Amen. Amen. Thanks, Rebecca. Join us, everyone, on December 22nd at 8 p.m., same time, same channel on Blog Talk Radio. Good night, everyone.
Good night.